And so how did you two meet?
I came back from studying in Vienna. I actually was in the Navy as a Navy musician. After I left the military, I went to Vienna and studied at the Hochschule für Musik for 2 years, guitar. I came back to study at the University of Iowa, much thanks to Jaime Vaxman, who's, you know, a legend there. And he wrote me several personal letters and hooked me up not only with the University of Iowa to study graduate musicology, but also with Coe College, where he said I could probably get a teaching job. So I was able to intersect with Jan in both of those places because she had been teaching at Coe for many years before that. I was starting my master's in musicology. She was starting her doctorate in flute pedagogy and performance at the University of Iowa. So that is how we met. And she had this collection of music and said, would you like to play? And I had a history of playing with singers. When I was in Vienna, I actually traveled around. I had a trio. And so I already had some literature I'd been doing. And Jan had all this literature. And we started our first performance was for her first DMA recital. And then we were approached by Grinnell College. And they said, would you like to perform? And I said, yes, I'm in a flute and guitar duo, and we'd love to perform. So that was our first paid gig as the Boland Dowdall Flute and Guitar Duo in the fall of 1979.
And so you were both students at that time when you were in the duo. So when did it morph into being self-sufficient and you were no longer students?
We both completed our degrees. Jan completed her doctorate in 88 or something like that. I got my master's in 86. And subsequently in there in 87, we got married. But we continued to do what most musicians do, and that is, for lack of a better term, cobble together a living from doing a variety of things. Usually that's a combination of performing and teaching. And usually that combines performing in one or more ensembles and then teaching at numerous small colleges as a part-timer and then having private studios. And that's what we did. We taught at Cole, we taught at Cornell, we had private studios, and then we basically toured a lot around Iowa. Sometimes we got to the coast, sometimes we went to Europe, but the money we made was basically not enough to sustain a living, so that was just part of our income. And we continued to look for ways to augment that and strengthen it. One of the things that was missing was a component of performing in our own community, because Iowa Arts Council grants were one of the ways that you could get a pretty good income for performing. But those grants were not available for performing in your local community at that time. There was actually a restriction. You couldn't perform within 100 miles or something of your own community. And so in the late 1980s, we developed a program we called Music for Seniors and Kids that was going to bring us in to the schools for 8 days a year and to 21 senior sites throughout the year. And we sold that concept to Henry Royer. And Henry said, well, I'll give you half of a 5 years funding for that if you can get the other half. And he referred us to Hall Perrine Foundation, and they gave us that. So that was the first time we actually had, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was $10,000 a year for 5 years. And we actually could plan ahead. Before that, we had what we called the big black hole theory, which means you would book concerts, you would play those concerts, and then your future as a performing ensemble was this big black hole that you were trying to shovel and fill in as furiously as you could. And this is where the sustainable income actually comes in as performing ensemble.
We were always looking for a model that would maybe make us self-sufficient, as you said, and I laughed, I'm sorry. But it is difficult for a musician to think in those terms. In the 90s, we did a lot of touring in Iowa. And as I said earlier, the venues started collapsing in terms of there not being a local person wanting to take on the responsibility of keeping a small arts series alive. I had spent 3 days with a very good friend of mine. Her name is Janice Weller, and she lives in the Twin Cities. She had a woodwind quintet that was incorporated. And I actually just lived with her for 3 days and said, can I follow you around and see how this works? And I realized they had a board of directors and they had people that cared. They had a community of people that looked after what they were doing and making recommendations. And I sat in her office and I read grant applications that she'd written and thought, oh, this is how it works. And I came away thinking, this is a great deal of work, but it was a model that really stuck with me. And in the late 90s, things changed a lot in terms of available places to perform. And it changed at all levels. We consider ourselves kind of that moderate level of, in terms of musical circles. We talked to people like James Galway, who said, well, you know why I'm not playing in a flute guitar duo anymore? He said, I can't get any work. Well, he's at the very top of the echelon. And so things were just changing. We decided to take a look at the incorporated model, and we took the plunge. We wanted to do it, one, because we not served our local community, and we thought that was important, and we'd love the idea of performing locally and in surrounding areas, 100-mile radius or so. And we wanted to work with others as well, and we started working with string players and broadening our repertoire in that way. We found a great group of people to serve on our first board of directors. We learned how to incorporate. We learned how to manage finances. We had people that gave us a lot of advice, and it worked. We had our fingers crossed, and we did take the plunge. We quit our college jobs, gave up our studio teaching, and it felt a bit frightening because we weren't sure. It's hard to get those things back when you give them up. We weren't sure it was going to work, but with the community's help, it did.
And I think what makes it sustainable is that once we incorporated, got a board of directors that maintains fiscal oversight for the organization, then these corporations, foundations, and the National Endowment for the Arts said, oh, you're a 501c3, you've got the structure, you've got the organization, you've got the board of directors, now we will consider your grant applications and for, you know, serious funding. So at that point, we started developing realistic budgets, and that's the part of incorporation that makes it sustainable and has allowed us to focus all our energies on providing the best chamber music programming that we possibly can.